Welcome to News and Bruce. I'm Meryl Yabake.
And I'm Mike Heslin. It's been almost a month since our last episode, and we've seen some actual history happen in that time. So today we'll focus on a few specific stories of historical importance. You may have heard that inflation is at a 40-year high. In fact, as of this month, it's getting worse, which is weirdly sort of a good thing if you're the Fed planning to continue aggressive rate increases. But also, inflation might not be that high depending on how you look at it, which somehow could be a bad thing. We'll try to make it make sense.
Spoiler alert, it makes no sense. But yes, the history making continues this week. Mike and I go on a global tour of world leader against their will departures, from Bojo in the UK to Sri Lanka, to the special appearance of not one, but two Super Marios.
Finally, listeners, we have a bit of a teaser here. We told you last month that we would only be putting out episodes every few weeks throughout the summer, and that was fully our intention. But listeners, we can't quit you.
I'm sure everyone that's listening is constantly refreshing your podcast feed, hoping for a random release of that periodic summer News and Brews episode. Well, for that one person, sorry, for all of you out there who are doing that, you're in luck. We have a great episode dropping early next week that will include an interview with Dr. Chris Blattman. He's an author and a political scientist and recovering blogger who specializes in the toughest of tough places around the world. And he's written a great new book called Why We Fight, all about war and why it doesn't happen as often as we think it does.
So it also happens that we are recording this episode while the season finale primetime extravaganza January 6th committee hearing is happening. So stay tuned for early next week. We'll put out another episode that has that interview with Chris, along with a season one recap of the January 6th hearings. It'll be sort of like a Real Housewives reunion show, just with just beer instead of who knows what substance is involved.
Can't wait.
Hey, Errol.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you, man.
We're back. Let's do this.
We're back.
Back again. Back from the back that we were back before.
Yeah, and sort of frequency unknown, but we've got stuff to talk about, and I think there's just a lot going on. So we should record.
It's been almost a full month since we put an episode out.
Yeah, well, I've kind of been a little busy.
Yeah, you're not just still riding high from the News and Brews happy hour in June.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. And we should do it again soon. But the housing saga that lasted a year on News and Brews ended, and we are now in our new house and
new studio,
which is not set up yet. And so I'm coming to you from the basement of my new house. And then it was hilarious because we moved on a Tuesday into this new house a couple weeks ago, and we're winning all sorts of Parent of the Year awards here. We moved on a Tuesday, literally around noon, our shit showed up. And then on Friday at 5 p.m., Lauren and I hopped on a plane to Europe for 9 days.
Amazing.
Without our kids.
So strong. So strong.
No, it's great. And of course, our older daughter had started a new camp and the younger daughter had started a new daycare. And so it was just we just ripped off all the band-aids
at once. And was your mother-in-law flying solo with both of them the whole time you were gone?
Affirmative.
Oh man, that's amazing.
Yeah, she was amazing. I was literally, I don't care if the house is a disaster, as long as the kids are alive. They don't even have to be healthy as long as they're alive. And the kids were not only alive, they were healthy, they were happy. The house was in good order. I mean, she was incredible.
Killed
she deserves
it.
All the accolades and all the awards.
Yeah. News and Brews bump right there.
News and Brews bump.
That's awesome. And I mean, congratulations to the whole Yabake clan on the new digs. Very excited.
Yeah, you should congratulate us almost more on the vacation that we took. But
I am impressed that you made it back from Europe without melting. So that's good.
No, it wasn't even the melting. It was the airline industry. And fast forward to, I thought this was going to be my spicy nugget, but I found something better. So I'm not going to rant here because it wasn't United's fault asterisk, it kind of was United's fault, but it's just, it was a disaster getting home. Like, we all said and done had three flights canceled. We ended up ultimately arriving in the United States in a different city than we were ticketed for. And they were like, oh, don't worry, we're going to send you onward to DC. And the flight got canceled again. And so we, if we had not called their bluff and rented a car and driven from New York down to DC on Monday night, we probably would still be in New York.
Yeah. Because, so you're saying you missed the opportunity to extend that vacation.
Yeah. I mean, at that point we were just so ready to get home and see our kids, you know, like, jokes aside, we did miss them. It was 9 days, slash our mother-in-law. Like, there's a diminishing returns after a while.
Right.
Solo. You've also been traveling though, right?
Yeah. Pretty a couple recently? Of places. We went to the beach. We went to the Outer Banks with all three kids and three other families and their kids.
Wow. That's a lot of children.
Which was, it was a high energy trip.
Yeah.
It was great. Like, honestly, these are old friends and, you know, all kids. It was nine kids, five and under in the house.
Oh God.
So probably a little bit different than your like adults only Euro trip.
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds exactly like Lauren and me lounging on Lake Garda for three nights.
That parlayed into the Vegas bachelor party for one of my best friends from growing up.
Whoa. Also with nine kids under five?
Fewer kids on that one.
Fewer kids. Okay.
Yeah. Although whenever we talk about it, Brew would be like, so you haven't told me which kid you're taking yet.
Wait, so is she solo with all three?
She was. She went out to her mom's house for like overnight, one of the nights, a couple of days. So not totally, but mostly.
That is, yeah. Well, Brie is an amazing person, because flying solo with two is one thing. Flying solo with three is not plus one level harder, as no, it's parents know.
Indisputably more than two.
Yeah, indisputably less than four, greater than two, but still a lot. Kudos to Brie. I know she's a listener, so I have to say nice things about Brie. There's a couple things going on. Should we talk about beers and then the news?
Let's. What are you drinking?
I am drinking a Dance of Days.
Lovely. News and Brews regular Dance of Days.
You know, it was like, we now have a refrigerator in our basement, and I was like, I don't remember when I last bought beer. Please, 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 please. And I opened it up and it was in there. The beer fairy was kind.
The system works.
What are you drinking?
So try to transport yourself to a beautiful beach on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. You know, sun is at that perfect golden hour level. The waves out in the distance just have a little bit of white on the caps. The sand is soft. It's the end of the day. It's not too hot anymore.
Bud Light?
You are surrounded by nine kids who are now comfortable enough with each other that they're just totally out of control.
Jack Daniels. But
you don't really care that much, because you've got this delicious swell, mighty swell, spiked seltzer water. From Austin, Texas, no less.
Yes, well, it's Austin, Texas.
So we were down in North Carolina. We started with, I should stipulate for our listeners, the summer of not really drinking beer or eating bread on doctor's orders continues.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been doing a tour de seltzer.
Mm.
Started obviously with the High Noons. It turns out in North Carolina, High Noons, very hard to come by. They can't sell them in the grocery stores because they have liquor in them, and they are mostly cleaned out of the ABC stores. So we tried a bunch of different alternatives. Swell was the clear winner among those.
Mm.
It's nice because it has like some actual fruit juice in it. So like, this is like 2.5% pineapple juice, what I'm drinking. And nice. So you do get a little bit of the sweetness, but not too much, and not so much that it's like carb heavy, but it's also not the like chemically questionable, not found in nature flavors you get from some others. And it's just easy drinking, the kind of drinking that'll help you appropriately zone out for a little bit when things get a little stressful and enjoy your summer.
Man, we need to tag Swell in this. That was quite the endorsement of fizzy vodka water.
Yeah, something like that with a little fruit juice.
With 2% pineapple juice.
Delicious. All right,
let's get into the news.
All right. Well, let's start with that old creep who nobody voted for, but just won't seem to go away. I'm, of course, talking about inflation. Last week, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released the June CPI, which showed that in the year to June, consumer prices rose over 9%. That might sound bad, but not a lot of people know this. 1% more, and we get a free sub.
No, that sounds really bad.
Yeah, no, that was a joke. It's all bad. The headline number was 9.1% year over year inflation, set a new 40-year record. It's the highest since November of 1981. Monthly inflation, so you know, from May to June, was 1.3%, up from 1% the month prior. Core CPI, where you exclude food and energy, had its highest reading ever at 5.9%. And all of these numbers were higher than analysts expected.
Yeah, but gas prices are going down, right?
Well, we'll get to that because we haven't actually gotten to the worst part of the report yet. Which is that these price increases are now extremely broad-based. So for a while, we've been talking about inflation for, what, the last 15 months or so on this show. And there have always been some outlying areas of low inflation that allowed us to say, look, everyone's stuck at home during the pandemic. So people are buying things instead of experiences, and goods inflation outpaces services inflation. Or, you know, there are specific supply chain issues that are disrupting our ability to get people the things they want, causing shortages, making prices go up. Or we're seeing an energy shock as Russian oil exits the global market. And those things might all still be true, but the hawkish case here, meaning the case to be worried about inflation at an even greater level, which is not that hard to make, says these different factors became sort of a perfect storm. And you know, we now have a generalized inflation and economy-wide mismatch between supply and demand. And yeah, the Fed needs to get even more aggressive than it has been.
Is that the solution?
Well, I mean, this would be sort of the classic case of the economy running hot, right? The labor market's really tight, wages are going up, prices generally are going up. You know, growth is healthy, but the Fed has to raise rates, undercut that growth, and cause a recession, then supply and demand can reach equilibrium.
Google searches for hyperinflation have skyrocketed.
Well, so after the CPI came out, the prediction market started to actually expect, you know, sort of took internalize this story, right? Started to expect the Fed to raise rates a full percentage point when it meets next week, which I don't know if that's ever happened.
Yeah, I mean, they were talking about 0.75%, which they just did. And then they were talking about doing it again.
So, yeah. So coming out of the last meeting, you know, sort of, will it be 50 basis points? Will it be 75? After the CPI came out last week, the betting market sort of took it to more likely to be a full percentage point.
Wow.
But it turns out it's way more confusing than that.
Oh.
So there are all these other contraindications suggesting we might actually be seeing disinflation, a slowing of inflation, and we might even be tipping into a recession already. So start with energy.
This is confusing.
You mentioned this a minute ago. We don't know when exactly the gas prices were sampled for the June survey on CPI, but if you look at what gas prices have been doing, they peaked on June 13th and they've fallen 10% since then. They've basically fallen every single day for the last month plus.
Yeah, I mean, my gas prices image is skewed because there's that one gas station on Connecticut. It's like Connecticut and Nebraska that's always like a dollar more expensive than the one that's a block away. You know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah.
We should cover that on Spicy Nuggets. That guy is really funny. But yeah, no, I'm pretty sure I filled up the gas tank on June 13th. So I have this sort of like buy high, sell low thing.
Yeah, just
trend in my life.
Just try to turn your headphones off when we get to the housing prices conversation. So that's energy. The labor market appears, and not to sell short, you know, Joe Biden going over and fist bumping Mohammed bin Salman, which you know may have some
which didn't
contribution
work
to. didn't work in that they didn't announce a, didn't publicly announce a plan to increase production. Who knows what they were actually talking about?
Is that who he got COVID from?
Don't know. Could be.
Joe Biden has COVID. Newsflash.
Yeah. We're just breaking all kinds of news on this show.
Yeah.
So we talked about energy. The labor market also appears to be cooling. Weekly jobless claims hit 251,000 this week. It's the highest number since November. Overall monthly job growth has slowed significantly. I think the average, if you look over the first 6 months of this year, is close to 500,000 jobs added on net per month. But if you look at just the last 3 months, it's somewhere between 350 and 400,000. So not alarming numbers there, not a downturn, but as you see jobless claims start to tick up, these are leading indicators. So it appears that the labor market has lost some steam as well. Commodity prices like agricultural raw materials and metals are actually down over the past year. There's been this weird dynamic in the commodities market where a bunch of commodities have actually been falling in price. Home prices are still rising, but home sales dropped 5.4% from May to June. So that's an indication that prices may start coming down there.
No, we're in other news, we're trying to sell our condo that we just moved from. Sorry, I was supposed to take my headphones off. My
right, bad. Right. We'll cover that in depth next time. Numbers from the Philadelphia Fed show the manufacturing sector is starting to expect a contraction in activity, which no one was really expecting that. They expected that indicator to be rising a little bit, and instead it fell like 12%. Retailers like Target, Gap, Bed Bath & Beyond are signaling they have excess inventories and will have to start discounting prices. The Atlanta Fed expects GDP to contract 1.6% for Q2, which would match the first quarter's contraction and put us officially into a recession.
Hold on. Can I go back to the Target, Gap, and Bed Bath?
Like, yeah.
Is it oversimplifying to say like, okay, you should put stuff on sale because of inflation, prices are high, and maybe one of the reasons people are not buying things is because it's too damn expensive?
Well, if people are not buying things, I think that's the question. You know, retail sales have continued to be pretty strong. We've got some other indicators coming out in the near future on this, but
then
you know,
how are their inventories?
Right. Well, the fact that they have excess inventories indicates that they're not as strong as clearly those companies were expecting. That's exactly the point, is this is an indicator that prices may well start coming down and economic activity may already be slowing. Right.
Yeah. So which doesn't sound like a terrible thing, right?
No, I mean, well, it could be a great thing, or it could be, it sort of depends on how policymakers interpret and react to this, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is, I know you've got more on this, more great news for listeners, but when we first started talking about this, you know, like you said, 15 or so months ago, there was one podcast that we both listened to that was basically like inflation in a way is sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like it's almost like a psychological thing. And I just feel like in every sector, companies are like, oh yeah, it's inflation. Let's just raise prices because like everything's going up. And so part of that is probably real because their inputs are going up. But part of it is also like looking out for number one and profit sharing, right? And like, this is why you see, I think, Joe Biden coming out and being like, yo, lower prices, like you're making record profits. So
yeah, the economist's answer to that, which you saw in spades on Twitter as the Biden administration was making that case, would be actually no, you know, companies are raising prices because demand is outstripping supply. And, you know, in places where that hasn't happened, we have seen shortages. And if it didn't happen, we would see more shortages. And, you know, we have scarcity of certain inputs because of supply chains. We have rising prices, both of many of those inputs as well as labor, which is, you know, an input to pretty much everything. I think what gives a little bit of the lie to that is that then a month ago, Joe Biden said, hey, we need to bring gas prices down. Like, what's going on here? And, you know, in theory, probably put some pressure on some of these companies with whatever tools the administration has behind the scenes. And we've seen gas prices fall every single day for like 5 weeks.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I think there's a case to be made there for sure. The last thing that I'll mention though, about, you know, these contraindications, right? These signs that actually we may not be having as much inflation and we may not be having as much growth as would necessitate a large rate hike, is inflation expectations. So to the point you were just making, right? A lot of inflation is a psychological phenomenon. And as people, actors across the economy start to expect inflation, it does become self-fulfilling because then you have to raise prices because you have to, you know, anticipate being profitable a year from now. And it gets baked into contracts and those are really hard to unwind and harder to slow down. And right. then the Fed loses credibility for its ability to fight inflation. The thing is, we're not seeing that. So inflation expectations haven't really gotten out of hand, even as inflation has picked up over the last year plus, right? Like inflation expectations were higher in like 2012 to 2014 than they've ever gotten over the last year. But right now, they're even on like the low end of a normal range. 5-year inflation expectations right now are 2.09%, which is just a hair above the official 2% target.
Like, meaning that even despite the year-on-year 9% that you just said, 5 years from now, people expect, like experts expect, only 2% year-on-year inflation.
Correct.
Okay.
So Derek Thompson has a good piece out in The Atlantic this week articulating some of these contradictions. It's called The Everything is Weird Economy.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen this, but this is like, that title is actually kind of what I was thinking. Like, everything's just out of whack.
Yeah.
Like COVID just threw everything. I was thinking about this on the airline industry. It's just out of whack. It's like, there's just, everything's off.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think a lot of observers have started to appreciate some of this weirdness a little bit more, you know, following the initial shock of the CPI numbers. So by this week, we're back to expectations of a 75 basis point rate increase for the Fed funds rate next week. But there are some people out there questioning the merits of gradualism in Fed policy at all. Right? Like, if we know we need to get to a 3.5-4% Fed funds rate, why don't we just make that the rate? Then there
what's
are other
that now?
1.5%. Then there are people out there saying, wait, there's a 9 to 18 month lag between when rate hikes happen and when they actually have their effect on the economy. We've raised rates a full 1.5 percentage points over the 3 months from March to June this year. And we're already seeing signs of both lower inflation and lower economic growth. So maybe we hold off. From the Fed itself, you know, last week, a Fed governor named Christopher Waller said he thinks a 75 basis point hike is necessary. Reuters surveyed 102 economists from July 14th to 20th. 98 of those 102 expect a 75 basis point increase. So it feels like that's where we're heading. Yeah. That being said, like, surveys are just vibes, and the vibes giveth and the vibes taketh away. So so I'll share some other places to look for the vibes. Frankly, there aren't many. We're recording this on Thursday night and the Fed meets Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. But we will get the PMI, which is the Purchasing Managers Index for both manufacturing and services, on Friday. That's the day this episode comes out. Those could signal signs of recession or resiliency in these sectors, depending on what direction they move. Next Tuesday, we'll get home prices for May, home sales for June, and consumer confidence for July. So that'll have some information. But I mean, the Fed's meeting is Tuesday and Wednesday, so we will actually hear their decision on the Fed funds rate next Wednesday. The interesting thing is that we will then get the first official number for Q2 GDP on Thursday. So it's entirely possible that we could see a full point rate hike on Wednesday afternoon and then be officially in a recession by Thursday morning.
Is that stagflation?
If the economy is not growing and we have high inflation, by definition, yes. The thing is that nobody really knows what to make of this GDP slowdown that we've seen, right? This is one of the contradictions that Derek talks about in the article, is the hiring has remained extremely robust. Even as we talked about the slowdown, like, these are still, you know, large increases in jobs in the country each month. And you don't really tend to see that happening while the economy is contracting. And so there's all kinds of theories out there about, have we lost a bunch of productivity from people working from home, or is there, you know, some other X factor that we're not seeing. But it's very strange and doesn't really make any sense.
What are wages doing?
So wages are going up, but real wages, because inflation's so high, are shrinking.
Are shrinking. Yeah. Okay. Wow. There's a lot there. And everything just sounds like a mess. I feel like we're on an Etch-a-Sketch and somebody just needs to just shake it.
More or less. I mean, I sort of come back to what you said at the beginning, what we've said before on this show, which is like COVID, much as I like to pretend it's over, is not over. And we're still seeing major disruptions, especially in China. We are seeing new variants emerge even just in the last few weeks, cases spiking. It's hard to measure because so much of the testing is happening at home. So much is asymptomatic. So many people are vaccinated or otherwise built up immunity at this point. But the best thinking out there says that we have more cases happening now than we did at the height of the first Omicron spike last winter.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to the extent that COVID has been the explainer for all of the craziness and economic numbers we've been seeing over the last couple of years, that could well still be happening.
Wow. Well, thanks for the economist, Mike. Haven't seen him in a while.
Just brought that one back from the beach, you know,
along with your hard seltzer. You know who else likes hard seltzer?
Who?
Boris Johnson.
That guy likes hard something.
So there have been quite a few changes in world leadership. And I would argue that none of these world leaders wanted these changes to happen. So I was focused on three of these, Boris Johnson being the first one in the United Kingdom. I want to talk about Sri Lanka a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll end in Japan, at least I will end in Japan. So we're recording on Thursday. And so yesterday, Wednesday of this week, one of our favorite people here on News and Brews, our favorite people of Turkish descent, definitely, Alexander Boris Defefel Johnson.
I didn't realize Defefel was a Turkish name.
You know, those Dutch, they stole Boris Johnson's relatives and tulips from the Turks, apparently. So Boris Johnson is out as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Listeners will remember that he was basically forced out as leader by his own party because of just scandal after scandal. And he lost confidence, not only in the public, but in his own party. Imagine that. Principled stances taken against a leader of a party who proved unfit for leadership.
Yeah, bit of a contrast.
We're just talking about the United Kingdom now. So not one to ride off quietly into the sunset. Johnson gave a final speech in the House of Commons. And I mean, House of Commons speeches, first of all, are stellar. Like just anyways, because people are interrupting. There's like standing up. There's like, yeah, there's clapping. You know, it's just like it's a really ruckus affair.
Yeah, it's way better than Congress. Congress sucks.
I don't know what the C-SPAN of the UK is, but their viewership is probably higher than the C-SPAN of the United States. His last speech was quite something. He sprinkled in bits of, you know, decent advice for fellow lawmakers. He said, for example, don't pay too much attention to Twitter. And he also, you know, did some unsurprising chest pounding about like, you know, historic parliamentary majorities for the Tories, how he delivered Brexit and all this other stuff. So like, okay, fine. So sprinkled in with those were several quintessential Bojoisms delivered as only Bojo can deliver. So two really stuck in my mind. One was that he called the Labour Party leader a, and I quote, pointless human bollard. I don't even know what it means. And I'm not going to Google it because it's better that way. And secondly, in a naked appeal to Gen Xers, I think, he signed off by saying in a very posh British accent, hasta la vista, baby.
Excellent.
Which is, of course, what all
that guy, knows so many languages.
Yeah, I'm sure he knows how to say like hi in Turkish and hasta la vista, baby. You just can't make this stuff up. So in more serious news, he's out. So fellow Tories Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss are the finalists to succeed Bojo as leader of the Conservative Party. I don't know much about either, but it's probably fair to say that neither is going to provide quite as much fodder to News and Brews as our old friend De Pfeffer.
So the way their system works is basically because they don't have to have another election, like it's basically just like Rupert Murdoch and his peers get into a room and decide who they're going to make the next leader of the Conservatives. And then it happens, right?
Yeah. It's like whoever has control of parliament, which right now, because of these majorities that, you know, he helped garner, like the Tories are in power, right? And so the leader of the Conservative Party is going to be the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
Unless that person's party loses confidence in him and they vote him out as leader. So this is basically like, let's say Kevin McCarthy is Speaker of the House. And in addition to being Speaker of the House, he's essentially like head of state.
It'd be odd if Kevin McCarthy actually does become Speaker of the House because he's literally made out of a giant Ritz cracker.
Yeah. So because of that, like his party could be like, no, we wanted you to say more about January 6th and you didn't do that. And so therefore we have lost faith in you. Of course, this is an entirely theoretical conversation, but that's sort of what it's like. And so in the UK system, they have whichever party controls parliament gets to decide who is the leader. Right. And so they still get to decide. Like, you know, they're sitting in a smoke-filled room and figuring out whether Liz or Rishi is going to be prime minister. The interesting thing is that Boris Johnson actually, I don't know the specifics of the charges, but like he actually could lose his seat in addition to this. So he's still a member of parliament. He's still going to be the one who's like, rah, 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 you know,
right, so like all their entire administration, like all of the cabinet ministers, they're all members of parliament, right? Who basically get elevated by the prime minister, or first by their party, right, and then by the prime minister.
That's right. And so the new prime minister will probably elevate different people because, as you'll know, like one of the reasons that that Boris Johnson left is because like his cabinet basically all resigned. They lost confidence in him and they resigned. And so those people no longer have jobs. But the next prime minister who will be part of the Conservative Party will, you know, probably pick all of the ministers. Some of them may be the same people, right? But also it's an opportunity to shake things up a little. So from there, we go to Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
And if you'll indulge me, I want to go on a little bit of a rabbit hole because Sri Lanka is a hot mess right now. Before I start, the Daily had a really good roundup of the main issues. I think it was on the 8th, but we'll link it in the show notes. Listeners may remember last week when, you know, vaguely sort of, wait, Sri Lanka, the president resigned by email, Maldives, whatever. So what happened is essentially the Sri Lankan president last week fled for reasons that I'll explain in a second to the Maldives, another country in South Asia, and resigned by email, which is pretty legendary.
That is a real power move. It's like I once got broken up with in the year 2005 over Facebook.
Ooh.
Like via a change in Facebook relationship status. It's sort of like that, but for the country.
Oh man. Change it. It wasn't even like a Facebook message. It was
you know
a
change
in relationship status.
I bounced back. It's all good.
Yeah, you upgraded. Okay, so whirlwind summary of recent Sri Lankan history, as I understand it, I think is going to be really instructive here. Because it's like, when you see this, you're like, wait, what just happened? You know, why, like, are these just unhappy people? And the answer is yes, very unhappy people, but there's a very good reason why they're unhappy. So there was a civil war in Sri Lanka that lasted from 1983 to 2009. So that's sort of where I'll start. And I actually, you know, I remember as a kid in Turkey, like as a pretty young kid, honestly, like hearing about how the Tamil Tigers, which is an easy name for a kid to remember.
Yeah, I also remember that. It's like a baseball team or something.
Yeah, and they've got a great logo. You can see it sort of on a t-shirt. And so they were fighting against the government. And that war ended in 2009 after a really, 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 really bloody offensive led by a guy named Mahinda Rajapaksa, who was the prime minister at the time.
Okay.
So remember that name, Mahinda Rajapaksa. So basically his government, after they, you know, just really destroyed the Tamil Tigers and honestly did some really terrible human rights violations and terrible things. After that, the war's over, they looked around and were like, hey, this is an island in South Asia and it's actually really beautiful. And oh, by the way, we have great surfing. You know what we should do? Tourism. And so out of that, they were like, we should build a ton of tourism infrastructure. And sure enough, within a few years, they, you know, at first it was sort of like backpackers and then it was surfers. And then they legitimately started getting the like British, Chinese, Russian, Indian kind of like tour groups. Cause it's beautiful. Apparently I've always wanted to go, never been. So all great gravy. They start coming. Unfortunately, they funded that infrastructure with super questionable debt, primarily, but not uniquely from China.
So was this part of like early Belt and Road years?
This was early Belt and Road. And you'll remember one of the most famous Belt and Road kind of debacles in the world is the Hambantota port in Sri Lanka, where it was like they couldn't service the debt. They, you know, Sri Lanka couldn't pay back the loan. And therefore China was like, okay, great. Well, we're going to take a 99-year $1 lease on this port and essentially establish a military base.
Yep.
In Sri Lanka. That's a really, that is sort of like the globally emblematic sort of like debt trap diplomacy kind of Chinese debt thing. And so that's sort of, it's emblematic, but it certainly wasn't unique in the types of sort of projects that were getting funded. Some of them were useful sort of infrastructure for tourism. Some of them were total boondoggles. So by the end of Mahinda Rajapaksa's administration, again, the same guy that won the war in 2015, things may have looked like they were improving, but cracks were already showing in that house of cards. So much so that he actually called an early election thinking that he was going to win, and Mahinda Rajapaksa loses his bid for a third term. They have a weird system where it's like a 6-year term, but after 4 years, you can call a early election if you want. And so he did that out of hubris, lost. And so he lost to an opposition candidate whose name I'm not even going to try to pronounce, who promised to reform the constitution. So mainly lessening the power of the executive. There was a lot of this sort of Chinese debt trap diplomacy, like went in the pockets of the Rajapaksas. Lots of corruption, lots of nepotism, et cetera. So this, you know, new guy was like campaigning on a reform agenda, sort of constitutional reform, economic reform, et cetera, which he had so much difficulty doing that Sri Lankans voted in Gotabaya Rajapaksa, Mahinda's brother, in late 2019. Now, I forgot this until I was doing research for this, but there was a really bad series of terrorist attacks in earlier 2019. And so that, you know, it's hard to say like, oh, it's just the economy, you know, like the reforms failed. It was actually like, look, there was a really bad series of terrorist attack that, you know, happened on your watch. And so you can see why, you know, maybe they wanted some security. They wanted to go back to the family that won the war. So I feel like there was a little bit of that going on. So Mahinda's brother Gotabaya comes in late 2019. Almost immediately, they're back to normal, like the bad loans, the boondoggle projects, the nepotism, you name it. And so, reminder, this is late 2019. The only thing that's really keeping Sri Lanka sort of afloat economically is tourism. And then something happens in early 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic, that essentially shuts down the economy. And Sri Lanka had one of the worst lockdowns in the world, the harshest lockdowns in the world. And you guessed it, the economy collapsed. So background for fast forward to last month, again, people have been dealing with this collapsed economy for like 18 or so months.
Yeah.
These are people who were like sort of in the middle class after the end of the civil war. You know, there was lots of really, you know, incredible development. They had a really great sort of GDP growth. Like, you know, again, the House of Cards, like, wasn't showing the cracks yet. And now they're like, people have no savings. They have no electricity. There's increasing levels of hunger and people were just fed up. In fact, hundreds of thousands of people were fed up. So Gotabaya Rajapaksa, the president, sees the writing on the wall and flees to the Maldives on July 14th.
So I saw something about this. I saw like a grainy video of supposedly this guy like getting on a big ship with like suitcases full of cash. Was that real, do you think?
I wasn't following that. That strikes me as very strange.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he took a plane, but it's a much better story if you're getting on a boat with suitcases.
Right.
Cash.
And just the suitcases and a laptop so you can send that resignation email and then you're good to go.
So a couple interesting points here for me. First of all, I think it's super interesting how much power the public has like in this. They were the ones that did this. And they largely did it peacefully, not, you know, or maybe I should say nonviolently. Like there was some sort of, you know, hopping over fences.
Didn't they burn down the prime minister's house?
There was some arson. There was some like property destruction.
It's just some casual arson.
Again, this is a country that like has, you know, survived a 25-year civil war, right?
Yeah.
Like things did not descend into civil war, right? Like, there's all sorts of interesting stories in the Daily episode talks about this, where like people were just kind of like walking through the president's opulent house being like, not destroying things, but just like, huh, so this is how the other half lives. Like there was like some story about some dude making rice on the like kitchen stove or something.
Yeah, I saw that.
In the pools and all this stuff. So I think that's like, that's a really interesting part of this where like the people very much had the power. The second thing is like, this is not over yet. Like president resigned via email, text message breakup, et cetera. The Sri Lankan parliament, I think it was today, literally elected Rajapaksa's former prime minister to be the president. So like
the guy whose house got burned down?
Who was like very much Rajapaksa's right hand in nepotism. Like is now the president and like people of course are still in the streets, right? So not gonna fly, the protests continue.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they can figure out some way for this to be like a caretaker situation and get to some elections soon.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the most likely thing is probably that some sort of like military takeover just to like quote unquote restore order, which we always know that ends well.
Yep. Well, thanks for that. Thanks for that journey through Sri Lankan history. I didn't know so much of that.
I feel like every once in a while I take an obscure country and just like kind of go deep.
Yeah.
It's really fun. This is half my show, so I can cry if I want to. My last one is Japan, which is decidedly less sort of interesting and I think way more tragic. Former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was assassinated on July 8th as he was giving a speech at a political event in the city of Nara. That is shocking in and of itself. Even more shocking was that the assassination came via a gun.
Yeah.
And so, like, of course, listeners are like, wait, that's not that interesting. But, like, to put this in context, in the United States in 2021, 20,000 people were killed by guns. Number of people in Japan killed by guns in 2021?
How many?
One. Literally one gun-related death.
Wow.
In all of the year of our Lord 2021. And so like, okay, so the attacker had some grudge against some religious organization that Abe was purportedly affiliated with or something. And like, it wasn't that he was like trying to keep Abe from running for political office or something. It was like, kind of a side issue.
So
almost,
have you spared yourself going down the Moonies rabbit hole as you've been researching this?
It's funny because I actually went down a Moonies rabbit hole when I was in graduate school in the year 2005. And I was doing an internship in Paraguay. Another story for another time.
Yeah.
They're super weird. And so this guy's like mom gave a bunch of money, like basically like gave all her money to this, like the Moonies, et cetera. It's
quite they're like a somehow like a right wing scam cult all like rolled into one.
Yeah. With like a pyramid scheme thrown in there for good measure. It's
yeah. I went down a bit of the rabbit hole. It wasn't great. I am happy we've gotten two different references to 2005 into this show so far.
It's good throwback. He made the gun himself. This is like a homemade gun. Mm-hmm. Explosives were also found at the house, and we'll link this in the notes, but Michelle Yeehy Lee wrote an article for Washington Post. She's an American living in Japan. And she wrote about like watching the aftermath in Japan through the lens, like through an American lens. And she talks about like, she had to unlearn walking into a room and seeing where the exits were, which is like what she was doing in the United States. Cause like, what if a shooter comes? I need to know how to exit. Like those were muscles that she had to like let atrophy and took a long time. So who knows what Abe's future would have been in Japanese politics, but he hadn't, I think, undeniable influence and has a real legacy. I mean, in part because he was the longest serving Japanese prime minister ever. He was famous for a lot of things and he was divisive for a lot of things. Like he was sort of this populist leader. Boiling it down to sort of two things for the sake of time is like Abenomics is what he's most famous for, I think, you know, like this like concept of growth that he championed. And then he took a pretty assertive, like hawkish foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And so starting with the foreign policy, he tried and I think largely succeeded to like put Japan on pretty equal footing as an ally and partner with the West, with the US and with the West. And so I don't know if before, like in the early 2000s, we talked about like Japan being together in the same conversation with Germany and the United States and the UK and Australia, but like they very much are, you know?
And I think both of those, you know, on the economic front and in foreign policy, like these were major departures from the trajectory that Japan had been on for decades, right? Famously in the 80s, Japan was seen as in some ways like China is now, as sort of the rising economic power that was going to be a major center of gravity in the world. And then their economy basically stopped growing for like 30 years.
Yeah. And so that's when he came into power, right?
Yeah.
Like he came in as prime minister in 2012. He, fun fact, had a very short-lived stint as prime minister. I think it was like in 2004. But he essentially made this major comeback. And from 2012 to 2020, he was prime minister. You know, when he came into power, like Fukushima, you probably remember, was in 2011, right? Yep. And so this is not only a like economic meltdown, it's like a nuclear meltdown that dude is inheriting. And Abenomics is seen in some circles as having helped return Japan to economic growth and strength. So
yeah, and then in on the foreign policy side, like, you know, Japan had completely disarmed after World War II.
Yeah.
Right. And under the US drafted constitution now exist under, he was really the first leader, you know, what was 60 years later, to say, you know, maybe we need to think about something a little bit different.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe when we are out doing military exercises with the US, if a US ship gets fired upon by an adversary, we should be allowed to help defend. You know, sort of like these some steps that seem really small, but were a sea change, a total directional change for Japan as a country, and will, for reasons that you may be getting into, will continue to have a massive impact going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think he saw a risen China as not just an economic, but a geostrategic competitor. And he was like, look, y'all, we need to do something about that. And as you mentioned, there's strong pacifist culture in Japan post-World War II, and the reforms that happened in the wake of World War II still continue, I think. Like that's, Japan is certainly not the country it was pre-World War II, you know, sort of strong emperor. Political assassinations, fun fact, were actually quite the norm before the war, and are have been very, you know, rare since, because it's a very peaceful, it's a very safe place, which is ultimately why this was a huge shock to the system. So, and I think there were lots of people, including some of my colleagues in my day job, that were really like cut up about this. Cause like, whether you agree with all his policies or not, like he was one of those he's like an Angela Merkel, like,
yeah,
lover or hater, like very influential person. And he was only 67. He had some more to give. So for me, I will always choose to remember former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe as Super Mario, which he dressed up as Super Mario in the closing ceremonies of the Rio Olympics as he was getting the baton, because, you know, Rio was in 2016 and Tokyo was in 2020.
Oh, nice.
So there are some, just Google Abe Super Mario Rio, and there are some really excellent photos there. So I choose to always remember him as Super Mario.
That is a great way to end the Abe segment, and a great transition to the hot off the presses fourth world leader to exit the stage, Super Mario himself, Mario Draghi.
Ooh, excellent transition. did he actually, so he's out? So I was in Italy. Fun fact, I was on this vacation that we didn't talk about, but I was in Italy and I got this like notification that was like, Italy's government collapses. And I sort of looked at Lauren and she looked back at me, and we were kind of like, collapses. Does that mean we can't leave, or does it? And then we looked in and it was like, no, it's just like a political, he resigned, or he submitted his resignation or whatever. And it has no impact on us on vacation. We're like, okay, fine. Close it.
Yeah. So at that point, he was not actually allowed to leave. He submitted his resignation as prime minister to the president of Italy, who rejected it. We are recording this on Thursday the 21st. And as of today, he submitted his resignation again, and it has now been accepted. So
is he gonna give a speech in the House of Commons?
I hope so. So you know, we don't, and I haven't really prepared a whole breakdown of what happened here. Essentially, you know, he was at the helm of a unity coalition spanning some right-leaning parties, some left-leaning parties. They basically started exiting his coalition over a variety of issues, some requirements put on Italy by the European Commission that he's been trying to pass through their legislature. But essentially, his coalition fell apart, and he was no longer able to govern. I think he has also been seen as a really effective leader in Italy, which is not necessarily known for effective, responsible leadership. Also in Europe, you know, he earned that Super Mario moniker by really saving the euro as head of the European Central Bank about 10 years ago. You know, it's a shame, I think, for many in the West to see him go. Not least because we still have this war going on over in Ukraine, and Italy historically has been a little bit of a non-aligned party when it comes to issues around Russia. But Draghi has actually been extremely strong in his support of Ukraine and their cause. And the expectation is that whoever may come next, and they will actually have to go to elections because it's not just a few right-wing tabloids that pick the leader in this country, whoever may come next will likely not be that way. I think the smart money at this point is actually on a far right party with roots in neo-fascism coming into power as the leader of a right-leaning coalition. You know, the big winner in this episode in many ways is probably Vladimir Putin. So we'll keep an eye on this, and it's definitely some worrisome possibilities coming out of Italy. But continuing that trend, it's been a heck of a July for world leaders.
Jeez. All right. That was a fun tour.
All right. Let's talk spicy nuggets. I've got a good one. This has been a long time coming. Errol, the Baltimore Orioles.
I've heard of them.
They're back.
They play at Camden Yard.
Camden Yards. They have been unspeakably awful as a team for many years. Come July 2022, little month you might be familiar with. The Orioles went on a 10-game winning streak.
Whoa.
A couple of days after calling up Adley Rutschman, who until he was called up was the number one prospect in baseball. So for a little bit of context, a couple of years ago, they brought in a new GM named Mike Elias, who has been sort of architecting a rebuild and team turnaround, you know, with a lot of like Moneyball principles behind what he's doing, brought in a new head coach, manager that is in
manager. Parlance. Yeah. Way to go. Like British Premier League, English Premier League.
And so, yeah, but it has been a really frustrating couple of years, just knowing that this rebuild is happening, you know, seeing it coming, seeing some encouraging signs. The Orioles actually have the highest rated farm system in baseball right now, but none of it seemed to be bearing fruit until this month. So we're in the all-star break right now. It's sort of the unofficial midpoint of the season, but the Orioles are officially back at 500. Things are just looking up. People are going out to Camden Yards again. There's just a whole like feel of Oriole magic to it. And that is my spicy nugget because it makes me happy inside.
All right. Take a swig of that little clear juice that you're drinking there.
Swell indeed.
Speaking of sports ball of the baseball variety, I saw that Juan Soto won the home run derby at the All-Star break. And this, of course, comes when he's renegotiating his contract with the Nationals.
No, he rejected their offer.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like it's negotiating. I mean, it's like rejecting, but it's, I don't think it's like done.
No, they're looking to trade him now.
Oh, I didn't hear that. That's unfortunate for the Nationals. It'll be a rebuilding century for them.
Yeah, it's a tough one, but they won the World Series.
They did. They did, baby shark.
You know, when the last time the Orioles won the World Series, only one of us was alive.
I'm bad at math, but that was
it was 1983.
Nice. So I'm going to take us from Baltimore to the shores of Norway.
Excellent.
Where a walrus named Freya has been photographed many, many times touring all over the country and getting onto people's boats and sinking them.
What?
Freya is awesome. Large. Freya has tusks. So one of the photos is obviously of an inflatable boat that cannot hold her weight. And so I just feel like Freya has got some really strong summer energy. And it made me very happy. So that's my spicy nugget.
Yeah, I really respect the reaction from Freya of getting onto a boat, realizing boats were not meant to hold walruses, and being like, this one sunk, I better find another boat.
It's strong energy. Really strong energy.
All right. Great to be here with you again, Errol. Great to be talking.
Great to see you. We will catch everyone very soon.
News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Thursday, July 21st, 2022 at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for listening.